From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, author Patricia Macias Rojas talks about the politics of immigration enforcement in the United States. Historian Craig Wilder discusses the relationship between slavery and capitalism. And Verdeen White of Earth, Wind, and Fire reflects on his brother Maurice's life and legacy. But first, the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe says poses a threat to its cultural heritage and its water supply is far from resolved. The Obama administration recently moved to delay construction of the pipeline, but support for the protest movement is still growing. Our guest, Amy Goodman, is the host of the show Democracy Now! For reporting from North Dakota last week, state police issued a warrant for Goodman's arrest, claiming she entered private property to conduct interviews. Ms. Goodman says the warrant is an attempt to silence media coverage. She shares her perspective with us now. Amy, good to have you back on the program.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Tavis.
I want to make the most of our time. Let me jump right in and ask you to explain to those who have not heard about this or have been hearing of late this story gaining some traction. Tell me about the Dakota Access Pipeline, this construction project, and what the controversy is surrounding this property.
So we're talking about North Dakota right now and the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. The resistance to this pipeline began on April 1st. This is a $3.8 billion pipeline that would make its way from the Bakken fields, its fracked oil from North Dakota through South Dakota, over through Iowa, and then on to Illinois, and then link up with a pipeline down to the Gulf. This is going through Native American sacred ground, tribal burial grounds, and the sacred and the Standing Rock Sioux tribe are deeply upset and are resisting. And that resistance has grown, not just one tribe, but at this point, hundreds of tribes are represented. Thousands of people have set up resistance camps, among them, for example, the Sacred Stone Camp. That was the first on April 1st, and the Red Warrior Camp. Native Americans are coming from the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Indigenous people are coming from Ecuador, from Canada, from Cheyenne River, from northern Minnesota. And they see this as a threat overall to their land, and not only Native land. This is a struggle that many people have joined in alliance with the Native Americans, seeing it as a struggle against dependence on fossil fuel. The Native Americans see themselves not as protesters, but as protectors. And they're deeply concerned that the Missouri River, under which this pipeline would go, if it was granted a permit, which it has not yet been granted. This is one of the longest rivers in North America, feeding, what, 10 million people. And they say they are water protectors, that water is life. And the resistance has only grown.
Who is behind the construction and who signed off on the permit for them to begin the process?
Well, that would be the Army Corps of Engineers. Mm-hmm. And it's very important you raise this issue, because there's been a series of court decisions that have come down, most recently in the last few days. The Sioux Tribe, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe of North Dakota, has tried to get an injunction against the permitting of this pipeline. They went to federal court in Washington, D.C. This happened right before Labor Day. And the judge there said he wanted a map of the tribal grounds, of the burial grounds that they felt were going to be excavated, going to be destroyed. They handed over that map, and many feel it's that map they handed over right before Labor Day, that the Dakota Access Pipeline Company got and actually targeted the sites that they pinpointed as their sacred burial grounds. And this is what led to a major protest on that Saturday of Labor Day. It wasn't intended, actually, originally to be a protest. The Native Americans who were at the big encampment did not realize that the Dakota Access Pipeline was going to be building that Labor Day weekend. They went to plant their tribal flags. There are a lot of ceremonies that are held as thousands of people are coming throughout the Americas. But then they saw the bulldozers, and Democracy Now! Was following them. And we saw one bulldozer, two bulldozers, three bulldozers, another comes over the horizon, and another. And the people were shocked. And this was the land that they wanted protected. And they moved in, told the bulldozers to back off, to stop destroying these sacred grounds. It wasn't minutes before the pipeline security, not police, this is just the pipeline security, one of the security officers tackled one of the Native Americans, and it moved on from there. Then guards were bringing in dogs, and the dogs were biting the protesters. It was really a terrifying scene. But the Native Americans kept walking, and the bulldozers were moving back. But the guards then sicking the dogs on the protesters, macing the protesters or spraying them with pepper spray, tackling them, punching them. It was a scene that was shocking. As Winona LaDuke would say to me, to the governor of North Dakota, Jack Dalrymple, she said, Governor Dalrymple, this is not, this is North Dakota. This is not Alabama. You are not George Wallace. And this is not 1963. I mean, you had dogs biting protesters as we focused our camera on one of what looked like a German Shepherd. His mouth and his nose was covered, was dripping with blood. And that same dog and its guard moved on. The guard just pushed the dog down the line of Native Americans, pushing the dog into the crowd. The guards were using these dogs as deadly weapons.
How, Amy, I'm not naive in asking this question, because I hear your point very powerfully, and I thought of Birmingham 63 as well when I saw these photos. It's so reminiscent of that era. So again, I'm not naive in asking this, but how can the governor and the state government, how can the Army Corps of Engineers make that the federal government? How can the government be so tone deaf? Because were this Forest Lawn Cemetery here in Southern California, just miles from our studio, or certainly were this Arlington National Cemetery, another sacred burial ground, or any place else I'd like to think in the country, other than on a reservation, somebody would have the good sense to say, we cannot just plow through a sacred burial ground. How is the government so tone deaf on this?
Well, this is absolutely critical. It's the pipeline company that was doing this. But the Native American tribe immediately went to the federal court to ask for a temporary restraining order. They got it in some areas, but not in this area. And then at the end of that week, this was, what, September 9th, Friday, September 9th, the federal judge, Judge Boasberg in Washington, D.C., ruled against the tribe. But it looked like it was going in that direction. So on Thursday, the day before this ruling, the governor of North Dakota called out the National Guard in preparation for the ruling, and on the same day issued an arrest warrant for me. Now, what happened with this video that we had, as the only major national journalists on the scene with video cameras, is we published it on Sunday, that was Labor Day weekend, and it went viral. More than 13 million hits. And every network, as well as NPR, CNN, CBS, NBC, all over the world, native sites all over, started running the bloody dogs and showing the dogs biting the protesters. And this was all building. In fact, you may remember that week, President Obama was in Laos, and he had a town hall with students. And the last question was asked by a young Malaysian woman, and she asked him about the Dakota Access Pipeline and whether the U.S. government would respect treaty rights and respect indigenous people. Then President Obama came back to the United States, and interestingly, although the court ruled against the tribe that Friday, September 9th, 15 minutes later, an unprecedented letter was issued by the Interior Department, the Justice Department, and the Army Corps of Engineers, saying they would not grant, at this point, a permit under the Missouri River. This was shocking to the tribe after being routed in this decision, you know, soundly defeated. In fact, it was Justice Department lawyers who had argued against the tribe. And it was the Justice Department that basically overruled their own lawyers. And they said there had to be a pause and an evaluation done, government-to-government meetings, talking about the U.S. government and the tribal government. Extremely significant. But still, the tribe appealed the judge's decision. You know, that was the executive making that decision. But the judge's decision, and just in the last few days, the appeals court ruled, well, sided with the tribe and said that it's not only that the pipeline has to voluntarily stop until full environmental assessments are done, but they said they were mandating them to stop the court. This is very significant, and it stems from the remarkable resistance. The largest unification of tribes, over 200 tribes gathering, saying no to a fossil fuel economy, no to destruction of their land, and repeatedly their mantra is water is life.
There are a couple of questions I want to ask now. One is, back to the comment you made a moment ago, and I know I've had this experience to some degree myself. No journalist wants to become the story. You were in North Dakota to cover this story, and yet you become a part of the story when there's an arrest warrant issued for you. I opened this program tonight by asking the audience what it says about free speech in this country. When a journalist of your stature, any journalist, but certainly one of your stature, who acknowledges and announces that she's on location as a reporter, we can hear you on tape telling these persons you're there as a reporter to cover this story. What does it say then when a journalist of your stature is then issued an arrest warrant?
Well, it's very significant, and I will definitely fight these charges. It is unacceptable. But I can turn to the criminal complaint itself. It says North Dakota, you know, versus Amy Goodman. But the criminal complaint itself says that I identify myself and am seen interviewing protesters about their protest, which is exactly what I was doing.
Yeah.
Precisely doing my constitutionally protected job. And that's what the criminal complaint said. I think the problem is that it sends a message to all journalists, and I'm especially concerned about young independent journalists, that the price is too high to go and cover this issue. But that's our job as journalists, is to go to where the silence is. You know, Tavis, it is not silent in North Dakota. The indigenous people are speaking out strongly and firmly, not only for their own tribe, but for the fate of the planet, climate change. It's just that it's not hitting the corporate media radar, which is why they are using our footage. I mean, to see the dogs, the people screaming, seeing the wounds of the dogs is absolutely terrifying. And that is our job, to be there. You know, there's a reason that freedom of the press is so important. Because it serves the public's right to know. How do people make decisions if they are not informed? An independent media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society.
We are in the midst of a season where we have been discussing and, for some, debating, some not accepting the notion that Black lives matter. And, of course, that turns into this notion that blue lives matter. The question I'm asking you, I guess, is whether or not these lives matter. Do the lives of these Native Americans matter? Were these persons not Native Americans, might they be treated differently?
Oh, I mean, I think there is no question. And interesting that you should raise Black Lives Matter, because Black Lives Matter activists have gone in solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and with many of the other nations who have come, indigenous nations, American Indians from Canada, from Latin America, and from throughout the United States. It is a real map of the proud tradition and legacy of people standing up as protectors of the land. But these are movements that need to be heard, and all of the corporate media has a responsibility as well. You know, it's our job to cover movements, because movements make history.
Tell me how and why, it's probably a better way to put it, how and why, Amy, the issue of water has been pushed so high up on the political agenda in this season.
Well, you know, this is an issue all over the world. And in the United States, the people of California, where you are, Tavis, is so important because you have a drought. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the native people of North Dakota, they're the land, the Cannonball River, the Missouri River, they worship clean water. You know, one young man from the Pine Ridge Reservation who was bitten by a dog who was pepper sprayed, I talked to him after and asked him if this was worth the price. He said, you know, even these guards, they need water. We're doing this for them as well, because we all need water. They're fighting for clean water. And as Winona said, who had come in from northern Minnesota, from the White Earth Reservation, you know, they had fought a pipeline that was going across their land. That was the Sandpiper Pipeline. And just before Labor Day, they learned that, well, the company was not going to build because of their resistance for, oh, year after year. And Winona said, I'm not going to spend the 10 years, next 10 years of my life, she is an Ojibwe activist, fighting one pipeline after another. Yeah. We need a sane policy, energy policy, where we look overall at this country and what renewable energy means. I was speaking to Dave Archambault, the tribal chair of the Standing Rock Sioux, and he says, what about wind? What about solar? I mean, this is what will save not only Native Americans, it'll save all of us.
Yeah. Since you mentioned these pipelines, let me ask what the parallels are, as you see them, Amy, between the fight against the Keystone Pipeline. Again, for those who might not have heard as yet of this fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline, thanks to Barack Obama and his intransigence for a certain time, and thanks to Hillary Clinton and her flip-flopping on the Keystone issue, at least most Americans, I think, have at least heard of the Keystone Pipeline now. What are the parallels between the fight against this Dakota Access Pipeline politically and the Keystone Pipeline?
Oh, I mean, this is very important, and there are a lot of parallels. I think a big difference why the Keystone, at least for a period of time, got a lot of attention. I think the Keystone XL got much more attention because it was not only Native Americans who were fighting against it. But I have to say, it is Native Americans standing tall, standing proud with allies from all over. The Dakota Access Pipeline is almost as long as the Keystone XL.
Uh-huh.
And it has enormous significance. Keystone was coming from the dirtiest tar sands in Alberta, Canada. And what oil the Dakota Access Pipeline is getting is from the Bakken oil fields. It's fracked oil. You raised Hillary Clinton, and it's a very important issue. On what side does she stand here? Bernie Sanders had a major rally in Washington, D.C. recently, coming out against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Hillary Clinton has not made her position clear yet. On Keystone XL, she was for it before she was against it, and she became against it because of movements. Movements demanding that if she was going to be the Democratic Party candidate, she had to bend to the will of the people, respond to people. That's mm-hmm. what democracy is. And Bill McKibben just wrote an open letter, the founder of 350.org, asking Hillary Clinton, why hasn't she mm-hmm. spoken out on this issue? And it's a critical point. We're talking about fracked oil. We're talking about an area of North Dakota, the Bakken oil fields, also extremely dirty oil. And I was speaking to an oil truck driver who's been driving there in the Bakken oil fields for like 4 years. He said, you know, that the bottom has dropped out of the oil market. I mean, in the last year, there is so much less demand for this oil. You could just see it, the destruction of the native lands, the pipeline built, and then it's just set aside. Mm. They don't need it anymore. But the Native American people are saying they're not going to accept this, and they're pushing hard to ensure that, like the Sandpiper Pipeline, this $3.8 billion pipeline does not get built, and the resources and the federal government, you know, working with this pipeline company, instead pours the money into renewables.
Yeah. Let me ask what you think it's going to take to get Secretary Clinton on the record on this issue. And I ask that again because we saw the flip she did on the Keystone Pipeline. You make the point very clearly that she finally came to the right decision because she was pressured. And so that, again, is how democracy works. But it just seems to me that you have to learn some lessons at some point. So if you got pushed on the Keystone Pipeline to eventually get to the right place, why do we have to go through the same process again to push and push and push and protest and protest and protest, and finally somebody wakes up and they get that they should have come out against this a long time ago? What's it going to take to get her on the record? And I'm not beating up on her. I suspect that Mr. Trump doesn't know about it, doesn't care about it, and will never be, you know, with the people anyway. But at least Hillary Clinton, you feel you have someone to appeal to. How do you read that?
Well, it's just about movements. It's really not about her, and it's really not about him. These politicians need votes in this critical election year. And it's a matter of how loud those voices are and people banding together, making their demands. It's not about the individual. You saw that Hillary Clinton changed her view on the Iraq war. Well, because Barack Obama, the senator who was running for president, he was opposed to the Iraq war. She was for it. She voted for it as a senator. And it was only when she lost that she accepted that she had made a wrong decision and now says that decision was wrong. And why did he win on this issue? Because movements, people deeply concerned about peace, deeply concerned about energy independence. And for many people, that doesn't mean fracked oil in the United States. Again, it means wind. It means solar. It means preserving this planet and taking climate change seriously. It's all about the movements. You know, a candidate that becomes president, whoever that is a door. The door opens a crack. The question of whether it'll be kicked open or slammed shut is not up to that one person in the Oval Office. It's up to all the people who have pushed through history to make a difference.
There was an issue of New York Magazine you might have seen just, I guess, a couple months ago, if that long ago. Huge cover story. You can go online and read it. And I only raise it, I should say, full disclosure, I was a part of the story as one of the many members of the media that New York Magazine interviewed for a cover story. The entire magazine, I think, was dedicated to this notion of what's wrong with the mainstream media. And it was interesting to hear the voices of persons in the mainstream media critique what's wrong with the mainstream media. But I raise that, Amy, because one of the points I made in my section of the story was that the mainstream media so often these days is just late to the story. They have all the resources, they have all the staff, they have all the money, and they've got the cable networks and network outlets, and yet so often they are late to these stories. I made the point in my piece that were it not for the black media in particular, the story of Trayvon Martin would never have become the mainstream media story that it was. In black radio, in the black blogosphere, they were raising this issue for weeks and weeks and weeks before the mainstream media finally came to the story. And now everybody knows, of course, the name, sadly, of Trayvon Martin. I raise that to ask, where do you find the resources and how does an independent production like Democracy Now get to North Dakota and other places to cover these stories before the mainstream media even hears about it?
I mean, it's much more about being tapped into what's happening on the ground. How were we covering Occupy Wall Street before September 17, 2011? And then there, as the corporate media, even though it was in the media metropolis of the world in New York City and the media moguls were driving by in their limousines, they weren't covering this. And then when they finally were forced to, thousands of people camping out, you know, right next to Wall Street, they ridiculed them. But they persisted, and that movement has, you know, changed history. They occupy the language. Everyone knows what 99% is and what 1% is. And I think Native Americans are following that tradition. They are there. They are camped out. Their numbers are only growing. They lose court decisions, then they win court decisions, then an unprecedented letter comes from the executive, from President Obama on down, saying that the Army and the Interior and the Justice Departments will support the tribe in some kind of communication that will lead to a decision that is justly made. Whether that happens, though, that's right, not determined. And then finally, an appeals court decision coming down and saying the company cannot continue to build in the area around the Missouri River. They are building in other places. And by the way, Native Americans are taking their battle 50, 70 miles away from the campgrounds, wherever they see the pipeline being built. And they're risking so much. Well over scores of people are being arrested at protests. Some of them are locking down. They feel that it's only going to come from their resistance on the ground. It's the government and it's the courts responding to that. Mm. So they're just moving forward.
Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, thank you for your work. Thank you for your witness. Always good to have you on the program, Amy.
Thank you so much, Tavis.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Since 2009, as instructed by Congress, Customs Enforcement fills nearly 35,000 beds every day in detention facilities with immigrant detainees, many of them children. It's a little-known mandate that is the subject of an upcoming book by Professor Patricia Macias Rojas called From Deportation to Prison, The Politics of Immigration Enforcement in Post-Civil Rights America. Professor, good to have you on this program. I want to just start with a definition of what these bed mandates are all about. So just take your time and just explain to me how this works and who's mandating whom to do what.
I mean, I think even before we talk about the bed mandate, I think it would be important to just really point out that there's been a fundamental transformation in the way that we manage migration in this country, in the way that we enforce immigration law. And so I think it would be important to really just understand that in the past, what border controls were about were really about like permission to enter, who has whether or not a person has permission to enter the United States. And now we've moved towards a system that leans on the criminal justice system, right? And so when we think about the system of border controls today, you know, we have presidential candidates who are talking about a border wall, for instance. And these proposals are occurring at a time when there's actually been a decrease in apprehensions of unauthorized migrants along the U.S.-Mexico border. So we're seeing levels that haven't been this low in 40 years, right? And so what this does is it takes attention away from what's happening on the ground, and that's that we have fundamentally transformed deportation. And so let me give you an example. Sure. As, you know, as you mentioned, I teach at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and you know, I was preparing for class one day, and a student knocks on my door, and she's, you know, visibly kind of shaken, and she said, you know, they came and they took my dad. And I'm like, who came and took, you know, what's going on here? And so she basically said that ICE, that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, had taken away her father. And so here's this young college student in a situation where she now has to navigate the immigration system, the detention system, the prison system, just to be able to locate her father and be able to help. And so this is the thing that, you know, I'm really trying to highlight in the book, is that we have seen a fundamental transformation in the way we deport, right? So that we are, you know, incarcerating people like this young woman's father. We are incarcerating families. We're, detaining, I should say, deporting and detaining. But we're also criminally prosecuting immigration offenses that were previously considered civil offenses, so that we have a situation now where immigration has become the leading charge sending people to prison, not drugs. And so it's this blending, right? It's this merging of these two systems that were previously separate that I'm, you know, that I investigate in the book.
Because we now see more persons locked up because of immigration violations, as opposed to drug violation, which was the leading source for years.
Yeah.
Tell me about this detention bed mandate. I want to get back to that original question. And who's mandating whom to do what, and how they maintain essentially 35,000 beds with somebody in them every night. What drives that?
I mean, I think that when people think about this punitive turn in immigration, we often think about 9/11. But when I was doing this research, you know, over the course of a decade, what I found is that the shift really occurs two decades prior, and that's with, you know, the Reagan era and, you know, the so-called war on drugs. And so what Reagan did, right? He passed one of the largest crime bills in the history of the U.S. And so what that did was it created a crisis of prison overcrowding, as you know. So it created this crisis of prison overcrowding. And so when I was looking at the congressional record, I could see that these legislators were basically trying to figure out what to do about these prison beds, this shortage of prison beds. And so they're fully aware that, you know, Black and Latino youth are going to be entering the system and they need to come up with beds. And so, as we know, right, one of the things they did was to embark on a prison boom, right, and poured a ton of money into prison construction. But there were other proposals, right? There were other proposals. There were proposals to repurpose old military sites. And one of the other proposals was to actually go after non-citizens in the criminal justice system. Now, we know that with the drug war, no one was more targeted than Black youth, right? And we know that native-born Latino youth were also targeted. And I know this because I grew up near the Cook County Jail in Chicago, and I grew up in a neighborhood that was devastated by mass incarceration. But there were also a smaller percentage of non-citizens, right? So these were folks who weren't even necessarily undocumented. They're folks who grew up here. They had legal permanent residency. They had green cards. And so these legislators are like, let's go after this group of people to free up the prison beds for the Black and Latino youth who would fill them. And so from then on, there's an agenda, right? A sort of what they call, you know, this criminal alien kind of mandate to free up the beds. And so in the book, I show how this then takes us to the current bed mandate. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to go there?
Please.
Okay. So what happens with this new targeted group of what they call criminal aliens, right, is that it wasn't that easy to purge them from the jails and prisons. Why? Because they weren't undocumented necessarily. They had green cards. They were legal permanent residents. They had long histories here, right? And so to really kind of be able to deport them, the legislators had to change the law. And so this is what the 1996 immigration law did. And so this is, as you know, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. That we're coming on the 20-year anniversary of that law. You know, that law is really important in the history of immigration enforcement. And, you know, it's a key piece to understanding the bed mandate, because what that law did was it fundamentally transformed deportation so that it made it possible to deport people with green cards and to revoke that legal status retroactively. So it didn't matter that you had lived here a long time. It didn't matter the severity of the offense. It allowed for people to be deported. It expanded, or it instituted, mandatory detention, so that more and more people were being detained. And it also encouraged this cooperation between the immigration and the criminal justice system. Now, what does that have to do with the mandate? So what happens then is that with this law, what essentially happens is that the prison bed crisis, right, which led to this criminal alien mandate, then created a crisis in the immigrant detention center, right? Because suddenly the immigration system needs beds, right, to put all these immigrants that are being swept up under this 96 law. And so you literally have, at that time, when you look at the government documents and the congressional records, you see the former INS commissioner testifying before Congress and saying, we don't have anywhere to put people, right? And so you see then from 96 on this sort of steady buildup of detention beds, such that we now have a detention bed mandate that legislates that you cannot keep less than 34,000 beds.
Got a minute to go here. I assume that most of these are private prisons?
Well, what's interesting is that, again, right, there was an expansion of a need for beds.
Right.
And so the INS, I'm sorry, the former INS, which is now the Department of Homeland Security, ran certain detention centers, and these are called service processing centers. But the rest of them, like around 60% of them, were contracted out to private facility. So I would say around 60% are privately
That's even more damning to my mind, at least, that you now have a private system that is mandated to keep no less than 35,000 people, essentially, in these beds every night. So they have to find people.
Absolutely.
And they have to bring people up on charges. They've got to fill these beds.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so this is the part that really surprised me. So one legal counsel for ICE explained it this way. He's like, look, if we only fill up 10,000 beds, we are obligated to fill the rest of those beds. And so this is what border agents are now expected to do. They're running criminal background checks on people, and they're finding that most immigrants actually have really low crime rates. They don't fall in these high priorities, and so what they do is they go further down the priority level. So you're filling these beds with people who would otherwise not be priorities for ICE.
And it's all mandated by Congress. That's the sad part. The book is called From Deportation to Prison, The Politics of Immigration Enforcement in Post-Civil Rights America. Professor, good to have you on.
Thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Georgetown University president recently announced that the institution would take steps to atone for its ownership of slaves by, amongst other things, creating an institute for the study of slavery. This move has reignited a conversation about the roots of capitalism. A collection of essays called Slavery's Capitalism, A New History of American Economic Development, provides new insights into the topic. Historian and author Craig Wilder contributed to the collection and shares his thoughts with us now.
Professor Wilder, good to have you on this program, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start with the story that everybody's been talking about of late. You probably know where I'm going here, the Georgetown story. Yep. For those who haven't followed that, just give a synopsis of what's happened at Georgetown and what decision they've made of late that people are kind of fascinated by.
Well, what's happened is the university, actually the undergraduate students, and particularly black students on campus, have been protesting and moving to get the university to recognize its long history with slavery. And one of the points that has really galvanized attention has been the sale of 272 people in 1838. Georgetown and the Jesuits in Maryland sold 272 slaves from Maryland to Louisiana, in part to help finance the university and rescue it, solve its debts, and rescue it out of financial trouble. And that's now coming back to really, Georgetown is now facing that moment and trying to deal with the legacy of that moment on its campus and in its alumni community.
And the president essentially announced that Georgetown would do what?
Well, Jack DeJoy, the president of Georgetown, announced that that the descendants of the 272 people would actually have special admission status at Georgetown. They made other gestures towards sort of a compensatory justice for the 1838 moment, including, you know, committing to a center for the study of race and slavery, trying to diversify the faculty and the undergraduate student body.
There are a lot of people, and I have heard and seen folk on both sides of this, as I'm sure you have.
Right.
There are a lot of folk who give the president great credit for a bold and innovative and creative move, the likes of which no other institution has ever done. So he gets high marks from a lot of people, and yet there are others raising the question about why there is no money, no compensation going directly to those family members who are still living, those descendants. Where do you come down on that?
Well, you know, the only institution that's come even close is Brown University in 2006 under Ruth Simmons,
Right? Exactly.
Her leadership. And she really created the template for how a university, and particularly a historically white university, can deal with this kind of a situation. I actually think that Jack DeJoy's statement deserves some credit. This is the first time where a university is actually taking sort of direct responsibility for its history with slavery and actually committing to the descendants of the enslaved. I don't think that the actions that were taken in the president's address are sufficient to close this conversation. In fact, I actually think about it differently. What the president of Georgetown did that day when he stood up with that address was he began a conversation with the descendants of the people who were sold in 1838, but also a new conversation with black Americans about Georgetown opening a dialogue with African Americans, which begins, in fact, with those steps, but won't end until really the full history of Georgetown's relationship to slavery is understood. And it's much bigger than the 1838 moment.
Yeah. When you think of the word, the term reparations, what do you make of it? How do you define it? How ought we approach it? It's a big question, but talk to me about reparations.
You know, I've been on the historian side of this for long, and so I've always seen my job as providing people who engaged in these discussions with the kind of information that they need for those discussions to be fair fights. And I think that's important to our society. We actually need a kind of honest debate and not one that's shrouded in myth and an absence of fact, right? Yeah. The pretend facts that we often use, right? And so for me, reparations is really about, in fact, a nation and a people coming to terms with its past in the most difficult moments in its past. And it includes, in fact, all sorts of actions. At Georgetown, I think one of the issues is the 1838 moment has gotten a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. But Georgetown University actually was funded by slavery for 50 years before 1838. Mm-hmm. Right from its founding in 1789 through 1838, it's tuition free throughout that whole period, like Catholic universities were. Mm-hmm. And the sources of funds came from the slaves on the Maryland plantations. Mm-hmm. The Jesuits were funding themselves in the United States and in British North America for 200 years before 1838. And so there's a lot more history to be done before we get a full picture of the scale of the damage done. And the scale of the relationship between American slavery and American institutions.
Yep. So that is slavery and education, or the institution of education, principally Georgetown University. Right. Let's talk now about the link between slavery and capitalism.
Right.
What is it that this book is challenging us to rethink about that relationship?
I think the book does a few things. Mm-hmm. You know, for a long time, black scholars in the Atlantic world have made the argument that slavery was critical to the rise of modern capitalism, that the British Industrial Revolution doesn't happen without West Indian slavery, that the United States' rise is dependent upon the slave system of the South. But mainstream historical accounts often dismissed that body of work, and typically argued, in fact, that slavery was somewhat tangential, that it was a regional institution in the American South, and while it's important to the story of the South, it's not critical to the story of the rise of the United States. And what's happening is, in the past 20 years, you've started to get a revolution in the way that historians look at slavery. And slavery has become central to explaining the rise of the United States and the rise of American capitalism. And so one of the things that slavery's capitalism does is it actually locates the features of capitalism, things that we think are sort of critical in defining capitalist institutions, and actually finds their origins in slavery, not in capitalism. And so, for instance, the insurance industry and the rise of an insurance economy rooted in insuring literally life insurance for slaves. So that you could actually protect yourself against losses. The mortgage industry. And the use of mortgages on slaves, or in other words, one of the essays in the book actually shows that Southern slave owners could actually mortgage their slaves and use the money from the mortgage to buy additional slaves. So that the value of the person, you didn't have to sell the person to get their value. You could actually mortgage the person and then use the loan to expand your lands and your slaveholding. And in fact, the expansion of cotton slavery in the South is an expansion from Virginia and the Carolinas and Georgia westward into Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. That's an expansion that's actually driven by new market and new credit market techniques and new finance systems that are in fact the basis for what we think of as financial capitalism.
None of this shocks me, and I'm not naive in asking this, but how is it that historians could have such a blind spot for so long? I mean, I'm not a historian, and clearly one with half a brain has to know that slavery was not tangential to U.S. capitalism.
Right. I think there are multiple things. I think one of the problems is that we tend to look for what we planned on seeing, right? That you're actually predisposed to a certain view of the United States. Mm-hmm. And the United States for a long time has actually had a rather interesting creation story, which doesn't begin in the South and it doesn't begin in the 19th century. It actually begins, in the 18th century. Much of it is in the North as slavery recedes from the Northern states. New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania go through their abolition processes. One of the things that happens is local families, local historians, town and county historians begin writing the story of slavery. And very often slavery is either minimized, its importance is diminished within family histories, within regional and county histories, within city histories, state histories, and ultimately in national history. And so I think part of it is actually that historians were predisposed to a certain view of the world. But I also think history is often a political project, right? That history is often at the center of the political, economic, and social fights that we're having. And so versions of the past are particularly important to informing how we view the present.
So we speak of the present, Professor, we live in a moment now where I think we agree there's too much poverty, too much income inequality, too little economic mobility. And so I guess the question is, what is the takeaway for African Americans in particular? And what is the takeaway from this text for the entire country? Again, and I wonder if you can situate that in a moment where capitalism doesn't seem to be working for so many of us anyway.
You know, I think this is actually part of what's changed in the past 20 years. You know, I think if you look at events like the celebration of the end of the slave trade in Britain just a decade ago, the New York Historical Society exhibits on slavery in New York, which had record-breaking attendance. The public's attitude and willingness to listen and to hear a different version of the story of the United States is one of the things that's actually moving and helping to move this scholarship forward. For Black Americans, I hope that, you know, when we look at books like this, we see a few things. One is that the way in which African Americans have actually protected the past and forced themselves back into the American narrative, demanded generation after generation that their contributions to the United States actually be respected and known, is actually finally starting to get embraced by the mainstream of academia. And I think that's fantastic. That's a wonderful transformation.
Finally, are there persons right now who have taken the place of African Americans who are now making the kind of contribution to this country where their economic output is being taken for granted?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I can start listing them, right? Undocumented workers in the United States, the people who we disparage and often campaign against in our politics, the people who we like to blame for our economic problems without actually understanding the way in which economies work in a much more holistic way. I think the folks who are incarcerated in American prisons and who work free or near free for for-profit corporations in that context, the whole industry that we have created in incarcerating people. You know, the next American story, the one that comes after us, has the potential to be as devastating as this one if we don't correct our ways.
The new text is called Slavery's Capitalism, A New History of American Economic Development. Some powerful and beautiful essays in this piece, I think, you'll be enlightened by giving it a reading. Professor, good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming by to see us, brother.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Known for its boundary-defying music, the band Earth, Wind, and Fire is one of the most popular and influential bands of the 20th century. Earlier this year, the band's co-founder, Maurice White, passed away after a long battle with Parkinson's. His memoir, My Life with Earth, Wind, and Fire, was published just this month. His brother, Verdeen White, a member of Earth, Wind, and Fire, joins us now to talk about Maurice's legacy and this moving text. Before our conversation, though, Earth, Wind, and Fire performing one of my favorites, September in Japan, 1994. Yeah, I love talking to you, but I hate to talk and interrupt that, man. All right, the whole stage was bouncing, man. There are some songs that you all perform and the place just goes nuts.
Go nuts. Yeah. They still go nuts over September.
The energy on that thing is just so. You cannot go to a concert, an Elements concert, and hear that and stay in your seat.
No, you can't. It's it's one of the most played songs in the history of songs.
Yeah.
And young people, older people, it's everywhere. It's in weddings. Yeah. It's in everything. Yeah. Everything.
Let me ask you to set your modesty aside. He was your brother, obviously. Mm-hmm. He is your brother, and forever will be. Mm-hmm. But what do you make of what Maurice was able to do with this band?
First of all, I don't know what was in his head. I think he was destined to do it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, he always had it inside of him as a child, and it was something he always wanted to do, and he had that energy and that drive.
Yeah.
And he saw things other people didn't see.
Yeah.
You know, particularly like musically, culturally, because, you know, this is also a journey through culture.
Sure.
You know, it's not just only a journey through music, it's a journey of his life.
Yeah.
And it's a journey through the culture of music. You know? And I think he wanted to express that to people.
As a fan, let me apologize. There's just a bunch of fan questions I have
that
I want to jump into.
That's okay.
Because we know so much about the music. We all love the music of the Elements. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's a fan of Earth, Wind & Fire, as I am, knows that Maurice somewhere, somehow, was turned on by curious about astrology.
Right.
It shows up in the music. Where did that curiosity and interest in astrology come from?
I think with him, you know, he always was a seeker, and he was always way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
And I think his ideas about the universe and spirituality and things, of course, that are normal today, yoga, meditation, things like that.
He was way ahead of his time.
Way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
And he introduced that a lot to us as well as the rest of the world. So I think that was his way of being able to expand his mind. And then don't forget now him being originally a jazz drummer.
Yeah.
And, you know, jazzers always were way out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They always had different ideas about a lot of different things. And I think he picked up on that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, we were one of the first groups to travel across the whole world,
and
which was always in his vision, you know.
A lot of folk who don't know Maurice's past don't know, to your point, Navradin, what a true jazz artist he was as a drummer. This guy used to play with Ramsey Lewis.
That's right.
Yeah.
He was with Ramsey Lewis for like 5 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, Wade in the Water, In Crowd. But before that, you know, he was the session drummer at Chess Records, on all those hit records, you know, those 45s, and that's where he met the late Charles Stepney, and that's where he met Ramsey.
Yeah.
And Ramsey invited him to be in the trio, and then I think once Reese traveled around and he saw how the world was changing and how music could be part of that, I think that's where he got a lot of his ideas.
Tell me more about how his jazz background influenced his work, his writing, and these other genres of music.
Well, you hear a lot of his work, like in tunes like Can't Hide Love, you know, all those great chords, that vamp on the end.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it in After the Love Is Gone, commercially, with great choruses and hooks. Because, you know, don't forget now, he was a session drummer, so he learned how to play commercial songs.
Right.
Commercial 3-minute songs as well as 20-minute songs.
Sure, sure.
And then, you know, he really put all of those together. We spoke about this the last time when Philip and Ralph and myself were here.
Sure.
You know, about, you know, he would be back in the station wagon and making, you know, Ralph drive. They threw me out the car, of course, right? Because I could drive, right?
Yeah.
Because he said, I already did that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was coming up with concepts then. You know what I mean? And then, you know, then, of course, you know, our journey wasn't as always easy.
You know,
you know, we had to break a lot of ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, and by the time he started the group, when he left Ramsey, he was 28.
Yeah.
But then he even mentioned in his book how confident he was, that he had it together. He knew what he wanted to do. And you could feel it, particularly when, you know, I came out here, you know.
Yeah.
And you could feel it when he was Ramsey, that he was on the way, you know.
So you guys are still traveling, still beloved around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Again, ahead of his time for a black band as big as y'all were, you know, hitting the world stage like that.
Right.
Why was that important to him to get out and see the world with this music?
Because I think, first of all, he was a traveler.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, we went to the pyramids together, Egypt. We went to Israel.
Yeah.
All those great places, Luxor, Egypt, Alexander, Egypt, all the places that, you know, I didn't even know was on the map.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think for him, he was a seeker by nature. And, you know, Reese wasn't like, you know, although he was like a great on stage, he wasn't really like a slap your back. You know, if he loved what you were doing, he would do just like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was kind of like how he did it, you know what I mean? And he was really an inside guy because he had so much going on, you know, in his thinking, in his soul, you know what I mean, that I think he wanted to take the music and let the whole world see, particularly a group of color, you know what I mean? Because through our music, they saw our humanity.
Mm-hmm. How did he process, because he didn't speak a lot about this publicly, how did he process discovering that he had an illness?
Little by little, but I noticed it at dinner.
Yeah.
You know, it just came, you know, and I said, oh man, what's going on, you know? And he said, I got a little twitch, and but it got progressed, you know, it was okay for a long time.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
He performed.
Yeah.
You know, it was only, you know, recently that it really, you know, got where he couldn't really do a lot.
Yeah.
And, but then he retired from the road a lot in 1994,
sure.
And that was the big thing for, you know, Ralph and Philip and myself to see how we could do without him. You know what I mean? And we got his blessing to go on. It wasn't easy, you know, because, you know, he left a big hole. You know, Reese left a big hole on stage. You know, we had to have dancers at first, you know, to keep that energy going. You know, we had to grow into it. You know, his aura was so big that we had to grow into that space.
In the book, though, he does question, and maybe even, as I recall, go a little further and says, thinks it was a mistake that he did not replace himself with another lead vocalist when he left the band.
Right.
How did you take that when you read that, when he told you that?
I think originally he thought that, but, you know, Philip, you know, just did it so well and took it so well. And it was actually right, because Philip sang with Reese all those years. So he actually was the only one vocally that knew where Reese was coming from.
Right.
You know what I mean? You know, you had to really work with Maurice. You know, like, we worked with Maurice musically.
Yeah.
You know, you had to really be around him to really know where he was coming from. And I don't think another lead person could have done it.
Yeah.
Because they would have done it more like, I'm a fan. Oh, I got to have all your records. I got all the rap.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not the person you want.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you want a person that said, we got to go out there and get this.
Right.
You know, and do this and serve. And serve the work and serve the lyrics and the music.
Yeah. Your father was a physician.
Right, Dad.
So early on, I mean, if you guys had followed your initial childhood dreams, you and Reese would have been Dr. Verdeen White and Dr. Maurice White.
Exactly.
You would have been physicians.
Physicians, right.
But somewhere along the way, you guys decided that wasn't the route.
No, now Dad dug music too, though,
because
he played drums and he was really hip to it. But what happened was he wanted us to be doctors, you know, to, you know, or lawyers, because, you know, that's what we did.
Yeah.
But what that music bug was like, it just was so overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, I needed it like I needed to breathe.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then when Reese started to fire, I was in college.
Yeah.
I had a scholarship, man. I was going to be a classical guy. I had it all planned. Make $50,000 a year. I had it together. Then he called. He said, listen, you want to come to California? I said, and I sounded like a little girl then, because I was young. I said,
yeah.
So it was a totally different world. And then I came out, as I call it, the second great American Revolution.
Yeah.
You know, we had the Women's Lib movement. Mm-hmm. We had Vietnam. We had the Black Power movement all at the same time. Yeah. And the hippies.
Yeah.
And that's really where this concept started in terms of expansion, you know, although it came from Chicago to California.
Sure.
And Reese, you know, he had one rule. He said, man, if you get on drugs, I'm sending you back to Chicago. It was more explicit than that, of course. And so the last time I saw Reese, you know, I was telling him what we were going to do 2016. It's going to be like this. It's going to be like that, you know, and it's going to be a great year. He said, it's going to be a great year. And I said, Reese, let me ask you a question. He said, what? I said, you still going to send me back to Chicago?
After how many years?
45 years. and then he said, I'm thinking about it.
What's amazing about, though, is that your brother, your big brother, brought you out, gave you a chance, he's your brother, so I'm not sure there's a debt there, but how do you process that your older brother invited you out and gave you the life that you've had?
Fear.
Yeah.
Because it was big.
Yeah.
Although it was small to the world, it was big to me.
Yeah.
Because I said, oh, man, I get a chance to work with my brother, man. This cat, great drummer.
Yeah.
I mean, if I blew it, man, it was over.
Yeah.
I was headed back to Chicago. Medical school. Yeah. That was it.
Yeah.
And the concept was great. You know, plus also too, you had all these great musicians out here, and it was wide open. And then every day, it was always something happening exciting.
Yeah.
He would say, man, we can really do a soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, with this cat named Melvin Van Peebles.
Yeah.
And that was Sweet Sweetback.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then we signed a deal with Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. Jim Brown was the first manager, the football player, and he was coming off the Dirty Dozen and Muhammad Ali. So, man, a kid out of Chicago, I mean, I met movie stars, you know, that we were actually, they speak, you know?
Yeah.
And then when Clive Davis came, it was like, it was life-changing.
It's beautiful and arresting to be reminded of how much music Reese wrote, not just for the elements, but for everybody else.
Oh, yeah, man, like Denise.
He wrote so much music.
Ramsey.
Jennifer Holliday.
Neil Diamond. Yeah. You know, hairdresser, he did I Am Love with Jennifer Holliday.
Yeah.
And then even now, man, all the young new artists, man, cats like Chance and Kendrick Lamar, they come up and tell me about songs they heard from their parents.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So he influenced, man, a lot. You know what I mean? So, you know, what he did was great. And this really is a book of testimony of faith, confidence, and believing in yourself and your dreams.
Yeah. Verdeen, good to see you, man.
Good to see you. All okay. Right.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.